Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, I'm extremely excited for today's episode. How are you doing, man?
I'm great, Danny. How are you?
I'm very good.
What's new?
Nothing much. School, work. That's pretty much it. We're studying at the library. Nothing new.
The school where they teach you everything that you don't want to know about nutrition.
Well, speaking of that, I switched my major to biology just because I couldn't handle it anymore. So
smart move.
Probably teach me a lot more in the long run.
I think that's a smart choice, actually. Good move.
How is the move? How is the chicken coop? Do you still have chickens?
We had to sell the chickens, which was sad. We miss them, but we just don't, you know, with baby coming and this space wasn't quite as conducive for it. So we dismantled the coop and said our goodbyes. And, so we're here. We're surrounded by boxes. I have no idea when they're going to get unpacked or if they ever will, but feels good to be in our new place. So
awesome. I'm glad it was successful.
Shall we dive in?
Yeah, let's do it. So why don't you introduce kind of what the episode is going to be about? This like a specific episode for your healthy baby course?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been teaching this course called Grow a Healthy Baby. It's about nutrition for fertility, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. And I've taught it live in the Bay Area a couple times, and it's actually sold out a few weeks in advance both times. So there's definitely been a huge demand for this info, and I've received a lot of requests via email and Facebook and Twitter and you know, comments on the blog from people who don't live in the Bay Area who would love to get access to some of this information. So I thought we'd do a Q&A podcast rather than just rehashing the material that's in the presentation, which would take 3 hours because that's how long the seminar is. I thought I would just focus maybe on the most frequently asked questions from the seminar, and then also some questions that I got from a survey that we did. Asking people, you know, what their main concerns and questions were about fertility and, nutrition for fertility and pregnancy and breastfeeding. So I think what we'll do is just start out. We'll dive into just some basic comments about the importance of nutrition in this realm, because actually I'm sure a lot of my listeners don't need to be convinced of this, and you know, you guys are all down with that, but it's amazing in the conventional world, there isn't a lot of awareness about how important nutrition is for fertility and pregnancy, or there's a mistaken idea about what kind of nutrition, you know, what is proper nutrition for pregnancy and fertility. Now, if we look at traditional cultures, we see that almost all of them had sacred fertility foods. These were things like, you know, organ meats, egg yolks, raw dairy products, fish eggs, things that were extremely nutrient dense. And they would feed these foods to mothers-to-be and even fathers-to-be. A good example is the Maasai tribe in Africa. They would actually only allow couples to marry after they had spent, you know, about 6 months consuming milk during the wet season, which is when the grass is green and the nutrient content of the milk is very high. So it's clear that these cultures knew about the importance of nutrition for, healthy kids, healthy babies. Of course, it's taken us another couple thousand years to remember that. But recently, modern science has rediscovered what traditional people have known for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And it's something called the developmental origins theory. And this theory holds that like all living creatures in early life, humans are plastic. And, by plastic, of course, I mean, just we're flexible. We have the ability to form new connections in our brain, and we're able to adapt to our environment.
I thought you were going to say we were made of BPA.
Right. We're plastic little toys from China. So what this means is during the developmental period, our organs and the systems of our body go through really critical periods when they're sensitive to the environment. And pregnancy is that period for us as human beings, and, you know, as it is for most animals. Now, the plasticity or flexibility we have during the pregnancy period enables us to get what we might call, a weather forecast from our mothers. And this weather forecast prepares us for the type of world that we're going to have to live in. So if the mom is poorly nourished, she sends signals to her unborn baby that the environment the baby is about to enter is likely to be harsh. And the baby responds to these signals by adaptations like reduced body weight and altered metabolism, which is actually a really smart strategy because it helps the baby survive the food shortages after birth. Is this making sense so far, Danny?
No, yeah, I'm into it.
Okay, good. Sometimes I can't tell if I'm making sense when I'm talking about this stuff. It all makes perfect sense to me, but my convoluted mind.
Like, oddly enough, in my biology class, we're going over reproduction. So I think might be the only reason I'm able to follow you.
Good. So, you know, to make this as practical as possible, what this means is that the 9 months of pregnancy are now considered by a lot of researchers to be the most consequential period of our lives. So just think about that for a second. I mean, they're saying that before we're even born is the most important period of time that in determining our health for the rest of our life. I mean, it's kind of not fair, really.
We have no choice.
I mean, and it, you know, as much as we'd love to blame our parents, it was the same for them. So it just keeps going back and back and back. And, you know, so there's good news and bad news in that, right? This period, though, this pregnancy, you know, the gestation period, they found that it permanently influences the wiring of the brain. And the functioning of the organs like the heart and the liver and the pancreas. And it also suggests that the conditions that we encounter during pregnancy shape everything from our susceptibility to disease, to our appetite and metabolism, to our intelligence and temperament. So there's some amazing research that has shown, and I cover this in the presentation, that has shown that babies that are born at a low birth weight, which is primarily influenced by maternal nutrition, have a significantly higher risk for diseases like heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, kidney disease, and things like that later in life. So independently of, you know, lifestyle risk factors. So we used to think that heart disease, you know, it was just simply a disease of lifestyle, like, you know, not exercising enough or eating the wrong foods. And certainly that all contributes. We know that. But what we're actually finding is that the conditions in utero during pregnancy actually strongly influence whether someone's likely to develop heart disease prematurely before they're 65. That's just amazing, don't you think?
Is this the definition of epigenetics, or is this kind of like not even that? Doesn't go that far back in our like genealogy.
No, exactly. This is more just the conditions in utero, and it does involve epigenetics. I mean, epigenetics is related to this in the sense that that is an environment that is then altering and affecting our genes. But you know, usually when epigenetics is discussed, that we're talking more about the environmental conditions that we encounter after we're born. So this is a whole new, you know, a whole new angle on it. So, anyways, that's just a little, not little. I mean, a really significant reason to be very attentive to what you're eating, you know, prior to conception. And during pregnancy and during the breastfeeding period, because it has a really profound effect on not only your health as a mom, but the health of your baby, not just during, you know, infancy and early childhood, but actually for the rest of the baby's life. So I know this is maybe sounding a little bit heavy and I'm freaking people out. And I don't want to do that, because stress, of course, is also not beneficial to the baby or to the mother. And if there's anything we know about humans, is that we're both remarkably fragile and remarkably resilient. So we know that, you know, babies are being born all around the world in pretty adverse circumstances, and famine and, you know, wartime and pretty harsh conditions. And many of these babies go on to live long and healthy lives. So we're talking about patterns and probabilities here. We're not saying that if the nutritional conditions are suboptimal, that you have a 100% chance of developing heart disease earlier on in life. We're saying that the risk for that goes up. So just keep that in mind, you know, as we talk about all this stuff. These are small increases in risk, but they're significant enough that we should really be paying attention. So again, I don't want to belabor this, because I think most people who are listening to this are already pretty convinced of that.
I'll add some lighthearted sound effects to that section to make sure.
Some Christmas music in the background, maybe. Okay, so why don't we? One more thing before we get out. I feel like I have to do the little mandatory disclaimer here. I'm not a doctor. Nothing that I'm going to say in the next, you know, period of time is medical advice. And I think particularly for you know, women who are pregnant and breastfeeding, it's important to be under the care of a licensed, you know, healthcare practitioner. And it's also important to know that while nutrition is, in my opinion, probably one of the single most important factors in determining a successful pregnancy and successful healthy childhood, it's not magic. It doesn't necessarily solve, you know, it doesn't solve structural reproductive problems, and it may not be enough to solve serious metabolic physiological problems. So, you know, this, what we're talking about today is how to optimize your nutrition and increase your chances of having, you know, the healthiest baby you can possibly have.
Agreed. Chris, only a zero carb diet is magic.
Right.
Just kidding.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's magic.
Okay. So let's get on to
the blood type or the Atkins or the paleo diet or, yeah, anyways.
Okay. Chris, do you want to get onto the questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. Our first question: what do you see as the biggest factor keeping women from getting pregnant these days? What one factor, if optimized, has the biggest effect on fertility?
Well, this is kind of set up, right? We just talked about it. I would say poor nutrition. I would say stress would be a close second, and actually, in some cases, it might even be first. It really, you know, these kind of questions are hard to answer, because I think there is no canned answer that's right the same for everybody. So if somebody's following a really good diet, but they're stressed to the nines, I think in that case, stress is the biggest factor that's limiting, you know, their chances of getting pregnant. If they're, you know, managing their stress relatively well, but they're eating, you know, bagel dogs and cheese doodles, then that's poor nutrition. I think environmental toxins are actually pretty high up there on the list as well, because there's a lot of toxins that end up being endocrine disruptors, and that throws the hormones out of whack and makes it really difficult for women to get pregnant. We have medications like, you know, birth control. If a woman's been on birth control for a long period of time, there's actually a medical term called post-birth control syndrome, which is basically means their hormones are totally out of whack from being on the pill for so long. There are a lot of medications that affect, you know, hormone metabolism and synthesis. So we could summarize all of that as the modern lifestyle, basically. The biggest factor keeping women from getting pregnant is the modern lifestyle. And it is a big problem, because there's already 1 in 7 women have trouble conceiving. And I just read a study out of the UK that suggested that number could rise to 1 in 3 by 2020, which is, I mean, that's serious. It's a big deal.
Do you think chronic dieting, I mean, all the women in my life have always been so obsessed with dieting. And I know from my sisters, they've all lost their periods like for an abnormal amount of time, and then when they started eating normally, it came back? Do you think that's a factor?
Absolutely. Because, you know, one thing we know about chronic dieting is that it elevates cortisol levels.
Totally.
Which is a stressor on the body. So, yeah, chronic dieting is a problem. And if there's any time in our life where we need to be nourishing our body and making sure we're getting enough nutrients, it's preconception and pregnancy. I just want to point this out. If I didn't make it clear already, it's not like, you know, we can just eat whatever we want, and then, you know, get pregnant and clean up our diet. That it's important to start. I mean, in the ideal situation, once you're planning to get pregnant, you start implementing the type of nutritional recommendations I make in the seminar and the home study course. It's about to be released. 4 to 6 months before you even start trying to conceive. That's the ideal. We don't always live in the ideal world. Often we don't, but that's building the foundation, so to speak, so that your body is ready and is ready to provide a nourishing environment for a growing baby.
Awesome. Cool. Let's get to our next question. How important is the father's nutritional status preconception? What should a man be eating to improve the chances of conception?
Well, yeah, I think you know it's not bagel dogs and cheese doodles, but it's a good question because I think a lot of people would be surprised to know or to learn that statistics suggest that in between 20 and 50% of infertile couples, there's a male factor that's either causing the problem entirely or contributing to the problem. I mean, I don't know if it's just me, but I think historically, from what I've observed, it seems like there's this idea that if a couple's not getting pregnant, it's the woman's fault. And I'm sure that's like partly this whole, you know, sexist patriarchal culture that we live in. But I don't know. Does that ring any bells for you?
I know just in my own experience, I mean, in the forums I used to frequent that it was always a problem for men. Are you talking about more of like nutritional deficiencies, like zinc deficiency and like the inability for proper like sperm?
Saying is that like when I look at who comes to my seminars, it's almost always women. And sometimes they're dragging their husband along and sometimes their husband comes and is willing. But if it's true that 50% of infertility is caused by a male factor, then you'd think 50% of the people, you know, coming to these courses would be men. But I think there's this persistent idea. It's not my idea. I just want to make that clear that it's, you know, more often the woman there's some issue in the woman's physiology, but actually, male fertility is, you know, it's right up there, male infertility. So, you know, the lower the sperm count and the poorer the sperm quality, the longer it will take to get pregnant. I think the omega-6 and omega-3 balance is probably one of the biggest factors in male infertility. We know that excess omega-6 promotes infertility in men. We know that infertile men have lower concentrations of DHA and EPA in their sperm, so they're not eating enough of the long-chain omega-3 fats. We know that metabolic syndrome is an issue in male infertility because insulin resistance upregulates something called aromatase, and aromatase converts testosterone to estrogen. That's bad in men. You know, men should be testosterone dominant, not estrogen dominant. And estrogen dominance in men leads to hypogonadism and infertility. We also know that oxidative stress is caused by, you know, which is caused primarily by excess intake of industrial seed oils, and stress and lack of physical activity can damage sperm quality. And then, another factor is obesity, because accumulation of fat in the thighs increases the temperature of the scrotum, which in turn adversely impacts sperm quality. So yeah, it's really important, the father's nutritional status preconception, because the nutritional status definitely influences sperm quality and sperm count, which are and sperm motility, which are the major factors in, you know, that's our job, you know, when it comes to that equation. So I think it's really important. I think it's underrepresented. It's not talked about enough. And guys, you got to step up to the plate and do your part here.
Awesome. Okay, so let's get to our next question. Do you recommend significantly different diets during the times a couple is trying to get pregnant versus after she becomes pregnant?
No, I don't. And I actually don't think that makes any sense whatsoever at all. I mean, there was a Harvard study. I talk about this in the seminar, where the authors found that women who consume skim milk, low fat and non-fat skim dairy products, skim milk, skim, you know, non-fat yogurt and all that stuff, had 85% higher infertility rates than women who ate whole fat dairy, which is, you know, significant to say the least. And then they even went on, they recommended that women who are trying to get pregnant eat full fat dairy. But then in an act of, you know, like exactly the type of bizarre, you know, no other word comes to mind than stupidity. They then suggested that as soon as the woman gets pregnant, they should go back to eating skim milk, or drinking skim milk and skim dairy products. I mean, I don't understand what sense does that make? If the things that nourish the body and prepare it for pregnancy and actually make it happen, how could that be different than what would nourish a baby growing in the womb?
I don't get it either.
Silence. Yeah. it's this groupthink thing, you know. It's like when researchers, doctors, people in general, whatever, get wedded to a particular point of view, it becomes really difficult to step outside of that paradigm, even when there's like clear research that is, you know, contradicts it. Instead of, you know, coming to the conclusion that maybe that whole other entire paradigm is maybe wrong, it's like this almost unconscious reflex to say, to go back to that. Yeah, well, whole fat dairy is great if you want to get pregnant, but as soon as you get pregnant, you better go back to a low fat diet. Like, I know these people are not dumb. I know they're very intelligent, you know, sharp people who are well trained, and I can see in my own life examples of where I, you know, it's hard for me to step outside a paradigm. You know, in my case, it's usually not the dominant paradigm; it's more of an alternative kind of paradigm. But so I have compassion, you know, and empathy for people in that situation, but it drives me nuts. So the answer is no. I don't think it's the diet should be different at all.
Okay, awesome, Chris. Let's get to our next question. Can I continue my paleo low-carb lifestyle if I fall pregnant? Is it safe to practice a paleo diet while pregnant? Most doctors say it isn't. What say you?
I say, how the heck are we even having this conversation if it wasn't possible?
this question's pretty self-explanatory.
I mean, like, there were 2.5 million years and 77,000 generations of humans eating a paleo diet, and somehow we managed to procreate and make it all the way up until the present day. So the idea that it's not safe to be on a paleo diet while pregnant is just preposterous. And I don't know how anyone with any kind of grasp on evolutionary history could say that. You know, so just on a real, really common sense level, it's obvious that it's safe. On a, you know, more specifically, the paleo diet is one of the most nutrient dense approaches to eating that there is. So if you're doing a paleo diet and you're eating, you know, organ meats and muscle meats and glycine rich foods like skin, you know, bone broths made from, you know, skin and bones, and variety of vegetables and fruits and starchy tubers and some, you know, moderate amount of nuts and seeds. And then you add some really nutrient dense raw fermented dairy, high fat dairy products. You're eating cold water fish, you know, for the long chain omega-3, and you're avoiding all the food toxins like industrial seed oils and grains, especially gluten containing grains and excess fructose and soy. I mean, that's it. You can't really be doing any better than that. And unfortunately, as I'm sure most people who are listening to this podcast know, the conventional medical paradigm is far behind and off the track when it comes to nutrition in general and in nutrition for conception and pregnancy and breastfeeding. So
I'm sure the doctor didn't even know what a paleo lifestyle was. Like, what would he suggest to eat if it wasn't for like meat, vegetables, and like nutrient dense food?
Yeah. Well, considering that most medical schools fail to meet the 25 unit minimum for nutrition that's recommended by the National Academy of Sciences. Literally, they're not even getting 25 units of nutrition and education. So why would anybody ask a doctor what to eat? Exactly. Honestly, and I mean this, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I have respect for most of the doctors I've met are fantastic people. They really want to help their patients. They're doing, you know, the best job they can do. They're really smart. They know a lot about a lot of things. But generally, and I think most doctors who would agree with me, nutrition is not one of those things that they know a lot about because they weren't educated, unless they've, you know, educated themselves, which a lot of good doctors do. But just because a doctor is an expert in, you know, surgery or, gastrointestinal diseases or whatever it is that they specialize in, it doesn't make them an expert in nutrition. So my advice is to be careful taking nutritional advice from doctors.
I agree.
That could get me in some trouble, I realize, but oh well.
Well, you already put the disclaimer out there.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's get to our next question. When I was pregnant in the past, I had terrible morning sickness. How can I maintain a healthy eating plan and deal with the food aversion / morning sickness / sheer exhaustion? How do you battle meat aversions and white carb cravings in pregnancy?
Well, that's another really common question, obviously. And I wish I could say that I had the magic bullet solution that worked 100% of the time, but the truth is that I don't. I'm going to give you a few ideas that can be really helpful and tend to be really helpful in my practice, and were helpful to, with my wife, who's now 5 months pregnant. But having said that, I've had women who followed all of these recommendations and still experience some nausea and some morning sickness. And we don't fully even understand why. You know, you can look in medical, you know, textbooks. I have a big, thick textbook about pregnancy, physiology during pregnancy, and there's a lot of theories, but no, we don't really fully even understand why at this point. And actually, interestingly enough, there are a lot of midwives who believe that nausea is actually a sign of a strong pregnancy. So I'm not sure what the mechanism there is either, but just throw that out there in case some women are worried that it's a sign that something's wrong. So one of the main theories is that nausea, morning sickness is caused by low blood sugar and hormone fluctuations, or from micronutrient deficiencies, especially B6 and zinc. So one thing that you can do is to eat, first of all, a high-fat, moderate-carb, moderate-protein diet. This, in general, helps balance blood sugar. And, of course, avoid, you know, excess, any kind of refined sugar and excess fructose. Another thing you can do is to eat, more frequently throughout the day. So you could eat like at least 150 calories every 2 to 3 hours to keep the blood sugar from dropping too far. And it's especially important to, if you're going to follow this approach, to eat breakfast within 30 hours of, or 30 hours, within 30 minutes of getting up. And even if you're not really that hungry, right, when you get up. And generally when people try this after, 3 to 5 days of doing it, they start to wake up feeling hungrier. So that's something to try. And then, stress management is really important part of dealing with nausea and morning sickness, because it can help regulate cortisol levels. And cortisol imbalance, or dysregulated cortisol, can wreak havoc on blood sugar. So pregnancy is usually a stressful time for women for a lot of reasons, and doing some kind of regular stress management throughout pregnancy can actually help with the nausea and the morning sickness. Acupuncture can be really effective. That was super helpful for my wife throughout pregnancy, and I did acupuncture with her quite a bit. There are a couple of acupuncture points located on the wrist that you can actually even just press on, use acupressure yourself. The point is called P6, and the way you find it is if you turn your, supinate your forearm so that the underside of your forearm's pointing up towards this, towards the sky or the ceiling. And you look at the crease of your wrist. If you take, and then you take your thumb and put it horizontally right against the crease of your wrist, that's one thumb length. And then if you put, move it back one thumb length more towards your elbow, that's two thumb lengths up. And then right in between those two tendons there, there's a point that's called P6. And if you press on that point when you start to feel, it works best if you do it right when you're starting to feel nauseous. So if you press on it yourself, or you have your partner press on it, fairly firmly, that can actually help quite a bit. So those are a few ideas, and like I said, they work in a lot of cases, but it's not a guaranteed cure, unfortunately.
I just found my P6.
Good.
Right in my
by the way, it's a really good point for anybody dealing with any kind of digestive issues or stress or nausea or any gut pain. Try it.
Awesome. Next question. What should I eat during pregnancy to minimize weight gain? How much weight should I really be gaining?
Another good question.
Should a woman really be concerned with, I guess gaining weight, anybody would be concerned, but like minimizing food or anything like that?
Yeah. So you must be reading my mind, because my response is, in most cases, the question should be, how can I be concerned about gaining weight during pregnancy? Because a lot of women, are doing like diets during pregnancy, and that's a really, really bad idea. If you're eating a nutrient dense, paleo primal type of diet, Weston A. Price, whatever, and you avoid the common food toxins that we've talked about, ad nauseum at this point, you don't need to worry about your weight during pregnancy. And a woman can gain safely anywhere between 20 and 40 pounds during pregnancy as a rough guide, depending on their weight prior to conception. So please, please don't restrict calories or try to avoid weight gain during pregnancy. As I said before, earlier in the podcast, your nutritional status during pregnancy determines the lifelong health of your baby. So you have to put on appropriate weight to nourish your baby. Don't worry, you can lose it later. If you follow the same sound dietary principles that we've been talking about all along. So gain the weight, nourish the baby, and don't worry about it.
Yeah, my apologies. I jumped the gun on that one. Okay, so let's get to our next question. This one is about prenatal vitamins. Okay. What prenatal vitamin parentheses, with DHA, what do you recommend? Are generic supplements targeted at pregnant women worth taking? If my diet is nutrient dense, do I need to take a supplement while breastfeeding? Are certain supplements, particularly that aren't standard, like fermented cod liver oil plus butter oil or spirulina, safe slash wise to use while trying to conceive? Also, she lists 5-HTP, progesterone cream, Vitex, etc.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a few questions in here, and we'll just kind of take them one at a time. Prenatal vitamins. The problem with most prenatal vitamins, like most multivitamins, is that they have too much of stuff that can be potentially harmful, like iodine or iron, and not enough stuff that is beneficial and needed, like vitamin D or vitamin K2 or DHA. In fact, there is no, I'm not aware of any multivitamins with DHA, because the only sources of DHA are seafood or marine algae and the creatures that eat marine algae, like fish. So you'd have to get a completely separate DHA supplement. DHA is in cod liver oil. I mean, I basically recommend that people eat fish to get the DHA that they need, but there's also some of it in the fermented cod liver oil, which I think is a fantastic idea during preconception and pregnancy and breastfeeding. Having said that, you know, and I also think it's always best to try to meet nutrient needs from food, because that's the way that we're adapted to getting nutrients, is from food, not from supplements. But, you know, again, we don't live in a perfect world, and a lot of times it can be difficult to meet all of our nutrient needs through food. So there is one multivitamin, multi-mineral that I think gets pretty close to how I would design one if I did. And it's made by Pure Encapsulations. It's called Nutrient 950 with vitamin K. And it's got, you know, it's got a good balance of all the nutrients. It's even got, you know, pretty good dose of vitamin D, and it's got both vitamin K1 and K2, which is really rare in a multi. So that's something to consider. In terms of specific supplements, a lot of it depends on food intake. If you're following a nutrient dense diet with animal products, like, you know, like paleo primal approach, that's adequate for most people, during, you know, before pregnancy and conception. But during pregnancy and conception and breastfeeding, you still probably need additional vitamins A and D from fermented cod liver oil. And this is especially true if you're not eating organ meats, which most people aren't. You might want to take additional folate, not folic acid, because they're different, but folate, and maybe consider freeze-dried liver capsules from somebody like Dr. Ron's for the choline, because liver is such a nutrient-dense food and contains a lot of nutrients that are really difficult to find in other foods. Now, as far as supplements like 5-HTP, progesterone cream, Vitex, etc., I definitely do not recommend taking those supplements when pregnant or breastfeeding without, you know, supervision from a licensed healthcare practitioner. And even in the period leading up, you know, there's no way I can possibly answer whether those supplements are useful or beneficial. Would completely depend on the person's, you know, status, hormonal status, physiology, what's going on, what they're trying to achieve with those supplements. I will say that I'm not at all a fan of hormone creams, because they bypass the body's natural regulatory mechanisms, which means that they can really build up and accumulate in the body and just wreak all kinds of havoc, you know.
Yeah, sounds really risky.
Progesterone cream, for example, like the upper end of the normal range is usually around 400. I've seen women in my practice who've come in on, you know, progesterone creams for even as short as 6 months, and they have progesterone levels of 4,000. So, you know, that then ironically what happens in that situation is they have progesterone deficiency symptoms, because what happens is when there's that much extra progesterone in the system, the receptor site shut down. It's like insulin resistance. You know, they say, we don't want any more. We've got enough. And so whatever progesterone there is in the system isn't actually getting into, you know, isn't activating the receptors and having the physiological effect that it's supposed to have. So women start, you know, taking more because they're, you know, they're still experiencing the progesterone deficiency signs, and often they don't get retested. So they just keep taking more and more, and they keep feeling worse and worse and having more and more progesterone deficiency signs, which doesn't add up, you know, doesn't make sense to them. Nobody's explaining it to them. And it's a big problem. So during pregnancy and breastfeeding, it's certainly like a very minimalist, less is more approach. It's always better to better safe than sorry type of situation. I'm very conservative in my approach with supplementation during pregnancy.
I think I know your answer on this one, but spirulina, not a good idea, right?
Yeah, I would say no.
Yeah, I think some doctor uses that to detox mercury or something.
Yeah, it's a key. Like it's some of the greens, the chlorella and spirulina, are natural chelators. I just don't see any need for it either. You know, if you're eating the kind of diet that we advocate, you don't need to be eating spirulina.
Especially trying to detox mercury while having a child.
Absolutely, because it can cross the placenta. Trade the spirulina for liver.
I agree. I totally agree. Okay, cool. Next question. How can I prevent getting a gestational diabetes as an overweight pregnant woman with PCOS?
Another great question. It's going to take me a little while to answer this. So, cause there's several things to consider. Number one, the diagnosis of gestational diabetes is somewhat overblown and misunderstood. There's a fantastic midwife named Anne Fry who's written, I have her textbook on, I think it's called, let me look. It's called Understanding Diagnostic Tests in the Childbearing Year. It's definitely not for consumer consumption. It's really technical, but it's an excellent book. And she, there's a great quote in there. She said, true gestational diabetes amounts to a diagnosis in search of a condition. So basically, the Cochrane Review, you know, Cochrane is a group that reviews all of the scientific studies and meta-analyses to see what the bulk of the scientific literature says about something. They found no correlation between gestational diabetes and poor outcome when confounding factors were taken into account. And what's more, the diagnosis of gestational diabetes is not in itself predictive of high birth weight. In other words, they didn't find any significant correlation between glucose levels in the mother and birth weight until birth weight exceeded the 99th percentile. So, you know, it might sound like I'm saying gestational diabetes doesn't exist and you don't need to worry about it. That's not what I'm saying. Hear me out here for a little while. I'm making a case. So, The important thing to understand that few people do understand, even in the conventional medical world, which is strange, is that blood glucose metabolism is dramatically altered in normal pregnancy, and glucose levels rise in a linear fashion throughout pregnancy. Now this isn't a sickness or a pathology. It's a totally normal physiological mechanism because the baby, the fetus, needs glucose to develop properly. But throughout most of evolutionary history, glucose or sugar containing foods were scarce. So to deal with this, the mother's body becomes naturally insulin resistant so that any sugar she does take in doesn't get packed away in her cells, but it stays in the blood and can cross the placenta and reach the fetus. Make sense?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that the placenta makes hormones like lactogen and estrogen and progesterone, which all counteract the action of insulin. And then the placenta makes really potent enzymes that destroy insulin, and shifts in maternal hormones also help suppress insulin, as does maternal weight gain. So In fact, as pregnancy advances, insulin resistance and insulin insensitivity rises to a level that approximates that seen in people with type 2 diabetes.
Sorry to interrupt. This is kind of like the physical versus pathological insulin resistance.
Yeah, exactly. Pregnant women are naturally insulin resistant.
And that's fascinating.
Yeah. And as I said, the reason for that is that the baby needs glucose to develop properly. And in Paleolithic times, you know, for the vast majority of our evolutionary history, when someone, you know, we couldn't just go down to 7-Eleven and get a big gulp, you know, there wasn't a lot of sugar around. There, you know, we had berries, and even the berries were not, you know, were really fibrous and not, didn't have that much sugar. And, you know, honey was seasonal and not easy to find. And so, so the woman, you know, women became naturally insulin resistant so that any sugar that they were able to get their hands on would go to their baby instead of, you know, into their own cellular machinery. So, yeah, so a woman, when she's pregnant, is naturally insulin resistant and is going to have different blood sugar than a non-pregnant woman. So that's really important to understand. On the other hand, a mother's pancreas secretes more insulin to compensate for this phenomenon. So that results in like a 2.5 to 3-fold increase in maternal insulin secretion by the time the baby is born. So if you put all this together, as you can imagine, if moms are naturally insulin resistant during pregnancy, eating a lot of processed and refined carbs is a complete disaster. And that's, you know, women, I think, have a natural carbohydrate craving due to that evolutionary mechanism that we've just talked about. And that was no problem when they're, you know, you couldn't just go get a donut or a bagel or something like that on the corner. But now that really dense, refined carbohydrates are so readily available, it's just a recipe for disaster. You know, and this, I think, is the real reason why we're seeing, you know, some rising rates of blood sugar problems and diabetes during pregnancy. So if a woman has pre-existing insulin resistance, which is always the case if she has PCOS going into pregnancy, it's important to eat a nutrient-dense paleo type of diet and to restrict carbohydrate intake to maybe about 400 calories per day, and to do resistance training, like, you know, like strength training. So really, I mean, getting back to the answer, how can I prevent getting gestational diabetes? As an overweight pregnant woman with PCOS, it's actually the same answer to how can I prevent getting gestational diabetes, period, which is to eat, you know, the diet that I just described, a paleo primal type diet with, you know, low to moderate carbohydrate intake and moderate protein intake, and then do resistance exercise, which helps improve glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity.
Awesome. Great answer. Let's get to our next question. This one is about birth defects. I am 29 years old, going on 30 soon. Are there real problems with pregnancy in the 30s? Mainstream medicine says my risk of birth defects is increasing every year I wait. What is your opinion about this? What can a whole food paleo diet do to minimize this concern?
Well, there is a really small statistical increase in the risk of birth defects as women age, but we're not talking about, you know, it doesn't go from like 1% to 50%. You know, we're talking about really incremental small changes. And I feel sad when I think about how much fear there is around pregnancy and childbirth these days. You know, it's such a natural, beautiful, instinctual process. And you know, like in traditional cultures, they don't have to deal with all the fear mongering that, you know, rows and rows of books that are warning women about all the possible birth defects that they, you know, their kids could have if they wait until they're older. And it really doesn't serve anybody, in my opinion. So that's kind of a sidebar, but, I think it's best to try to avoid as much as possible exposure to that kind of information, because in the vast majority of cases, you know, the births are going to be completely healthy and normal.
So turn off the news.
Yeah, basically turn off the news, eat well, like, you know, eat the kind of foods we've been talking about, and manage your stress, have fun, have, you know, cultivate pleasure in your life, like pay attention, you know, connect with your partner, if you have one while you're pregnant, and enjoy life as much as you can, and celebrate the coming of the baby. You know, like, pregnancy is a really sweet time. My only regret in the last month is that we had to move, but before, you know, which has kind of made our lives pretty crazy. But before that, Elan and I, my wife, have really just been trying to enjoy the pregnancy period as much as we can, because it's, you know, it's the last time that there's just going to be the two of us, and we're, you know, fascinated by the whole process of how the baby's developing, and, you know, feeling the first kick, and it's just a really amazing time. And for us, it's been really important to just not fall into that fear-based mentality. And so we don't, you know, read a lot of stuff about that. And we don't, you know, we've pretty much completely opted out of the conventional paradigm. We haven't had a single ultrasound, and we don't plan to. We're just having a baby, as, you know, millions and millions, billions of our ancestors have done. So anyways, back to the question. to my knowledge, there haven't been any studies done on how paleo nutrition particularly affects birth outcomes. But of course, we know that several nutrients that are found in abundance in the paleo diet are essential to healthy pregnancy. We know that both from anthropological research of, you know, what our ancestors ate for 2.5 million years. And we also know it from modern science. So, and the other thing is that, you know, I understand that maybe in the past 29, 30 years old sounded, you know, kind of getting old to have a kid, but really these days, 30's really young. So, you know, don't worry about it at all. It's like, I have lots of friends, you know, my wife's 40. I have lots of friends who are having healthy kids at 40, 41, 42. Is the risk of birth defects higher? Yes, it is. Does that mean, you know, it's not possible to have a healthy baby? Absolutely not. And in fact, all, you know, my small sample of friends and everybody I know, they've all had healthy babies. So, yeah, I would just, like I said, eat a healthy diet, enjoy life, enjoy being pregnant, and enjoy your baby.
Cool. Let's get to our next question. Is breast milk made up of all the nutrients that my baby needs, regardless of my own diet? If I consume foods higher in fats, will my breast milk be richer with a higher fat content?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, to not to harp on the evolutionary argument here, but it is a pretty good one. we've been around as modern Homo, you know, humans, the modern Homo humans, for 2.5 million years, and you know, been evolving for millions of years before that. And so Mother Nature's had a long time to figure out, or, you know, to get it right in terms of what the perfect food is for babies, and that's breast milk. And to me, it's like the height of human arrogance to think that we can improve on, you know, millions of years of evolution in that regard. But of course, modern science tells us and confirms what we could already figure out from just looking at, you know, from evolutionary argument, that breast milk contains, you know, it's the perfect food for babies. It has all the substances that give the growing baby immunity to infection and disease. It bonds a mother to her baby. It stimulates important hormonal activities in the mother's body. helps her lose weight after breastfeeding, helps her lose weight after pregnancy, protects her against future breast cancer and osteoporosis. And we also know, you know, like the World Health Organization has issued this report. It's really good. And it's actually pretty accessible to read. I should post a link to it when we post the podcast. They recommend exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. So, you know, no doubt at all that breast milk alone can meet the baby's nutrient needs, all nutrient needs for 6 months. And then they recommend complementary feeding, which means breast milk plus introduction of solid food slowly until at least 2 years of age. But unfortunately, statistics show that fewer than 35% of infants are exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months. I certainly wasn't. And, you know, most people I know weren't, because at that, you know, my parents' generation, they were being told that formula was better than breast milk. It's the most ridiculous idea in the world. I don't know how an entire generation of people could be, you know, hoodwinked like that. But it's that power of groupthink that we were talking about before. But so having said that, the mother's diet is extremely important in determining the composition of breast milk. And in fact, there have been a few studies in which the mother's nutritional status was poor that showed that breast milk didn't offer any advantage over formula. So please don't misinterpret this as a testament for formula. It's not at all. It's the indicator instead of how important proper nutrition during breastfeeding is. Breastfeeding has short-term and long-term benefits on both the child and the mother. It helps protect kids against all kinds of acute and chronic disorders. We know that infants not breastfed are between 6 and 10 times more likely not to survive the first months of their life. We know that formula-fed infants have an increased risk of long-term diseases with immunological basis, like asthma, type 1 diabetes, celiac, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and even childhood leukemia. And we've seen other studies that suggest that obesity and high blood pressure and heart disease are more common later in life in kids that aren't breastfed. And the kids that are formula fed on average have cognitive scores 3 points lower than kids that are breastfed. So there's all kinds of benefits to breastfeeding and especially following the WHO recommendations for exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months and then complementary feeding until at least 2 years of age.
Is it true if like a woman is deficient in vitamin D, her breast milk will also share that same characteristic?
It is absolutely true. And I think we're going to talk about this in a later question, but there was a recent study that showed that. So what happens is in the second and third trimester, as the fetal skeleton starts developing rapidly, that increases the need for vitamin D. And so that will tax the mother's supply of vitamin D. So we also know that 50% of mothers go into pregnancy with already being deficient in vitamin D. So then the baby really, you know, kind of takes all the vitamin D that it needs, which is considerable. The mother's levels drop considerably, and then there's nothing left for the baby through the breast milk. So this study in the UK showed that over 32% of babies were born with vitamin D levels of zero. They had no detectable vitamin D levels in their blood.
Oh my God.
And I think, I don't know if you remember the recent story that some vegans in France got arrested because their baby died because they breastfed exclusively for 11 months. They didn't introduce any solid foods. And one of the causes of death was vitamin D deficiency.
I remember hearing about that. It was really sad.
So anyways, yeah, good question. And it definitely makes a difference.
Our next question follows right into that. How do I make sure I have enough milk? How do I increase milk production while still maintaining a low carb, high fat lifestyle?
This question comes up a lot, and I'm not actually sure why it's such a big concern. There seems to be a some kind of meme that's been propagated out in the mainstream that milk supply is limited and it's going to run out, and you know that a lot of women run out of milk. And the truth is, if you look at this, you know, the statistics on this, it's actually rare for a woman not to be able to produce enough milk for her baby. Most women can produce, you know, 25 to 40 ounces of milk per day, which is plenty. And milk production is not, you know, while nutrition does have some influence, milk production is more a factor of feeding frequency. So milk supply declines when feedings are infrequent or restricted, which is one of many reasons why breastfeeding should always be on demand, meaning whenever, you know, whenever the baby wants to eat. Research shows that when a mother breastfeeds early and on demand, you know, maybe an average of 10 times a day in the first 2 weeks, her milk production is greater and her infant gains more weight, and then she can continue to breastfeed for a longer period. So that initial period, it's super important to breastfeed, you know, a lot, as 10, you know, the average was 10 times a day, but don't stick to that as a number, but basically as much as the baby wants to. And the milk ejection reflex operates most strongly in the presence of a good supply of milk, which occurs when the baby's feeding happens on cue rather than like on a schedule that's imposed by the parents. So the most common causes of milk supply problems, which aren't that common anyways, are infrequent feedings and sometimes poor latch on or positioning, where the, you know, the baby's not latching properly.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Chris, how can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, this week, you know, just a few blog posts and, you know, Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter. It's been a little slower than usual because of the move and getting settled, but as I mentioned a couple times earlier in the podcast, I'm really, really excited about offering the Grow a Healthy Baby course as an online home study course. I've been teaching this locally. It's been really well received, and I'm just really excited about getting the information out there to a wider audience. So I just want to tell you a little bit about it. It's gonna be, like I said, an online home study course. So when you sign up, you'll have instant lifetime access to it via a password protected website. We're gonna cover things like which foods supercharge your fertility and ensure a healthy pregnancy and lifelong health for your baby. We're gonna talk about which foods might be harmful for you and your baby and should be avoided. We're going to talk about what modern research shows are the essential vitamins and minerals for conception and pregnancy and breastfeeding and how to find them in foods. We're going to talk about which supplements you need and which ones you should avoid, which is an important topic. And then we're going to also answer common questions, you know, some of which we talked about today, like how to increase your chances of conceiving naturally without drugs, how to maintain a healthy weight during pregnancy, how to combat nausea, avoid mood swings, and address other common problems. I'm going to include a two-week meal plan with recipes so that you can, you know, get right at preparing delicious, nutrient-dense meals that'll nourish your baby, even if you don't know a lot about cooking this type of food. There's going to be that special report on first foods that I mentioned, you know, what your baby should start eating in terms of solid foods and how to introduce them to avoid any potential, you know, food reactions or allergies. There's going to be some information on how to make a nourishing homemade formula if for whatever reason you're not able to breastfeed, because, you know, despite best intentions, there are just situations where breastfeeding is impossible. And then we're going to have an audio program with a guided stress management program for pregnant women, which is, I think, really helpful in terms of avoiding the frustration and overwhelm that a lot of women feel when they're trying to conceive or get pregnant. So I'm hoping to release this course in the next 3 to 5 weeks. If you'd like to sign up to be notified when the course is available, go to growahealthybaby.com and enter your email address in the box. And I'm going to be making an exclusive offer to people on that list. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet, but if you want to be part of that offer, make sure to sign up on that list before the course is released. And yeah, that's about it for me. Thanks everybody for listening, and I look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks.